All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Fresh Side Podcast. Today, I am joined with Dale.
Hello, everyone.
And the one and only Block Chomper, also known as Block.
Hello, hello. Thanks
for having me. How you doing, Block?
Yeah, good, man. Good to get on this podcast with you guys. Happy to discuss some of the topics we've got on the agenda for today.
So you've had quite an interesting background, right, in Web 2?
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of... Well, I wouldn't say crossroads, like I feel like I know the path forward, but I've left sort of a corporate career of about 9 years in Web2 security, predominantly in TradFi, and I work for some SaaS providers as well. I've kind of posted about it's a pretty daunting task ahead of me. It's a very big switch going from like a salaried employee to a freelancer. It's a completely different ball game, and you know, it takes quite a psychological shift, I think, to you know, get to be at ease basically with, you know, waiting for the next contract, and also sort of taking ownership of the product, making sales, doing marketing. And that's, you know, part of the reason I started the video series I'm doing, Crypto Sec Diaries, sort of taking a different take on some of the content that's out there, because I think a lot of people go straight into the technical deep dive, and a lot of people want to know actually what's it like to be a security researcher, you know, what kind of life are you going to live, and you know, what are the day-to-day worries and stresses, that sort of thing. So I wanted to do something a little bit different, and that's been received pretty well so far, which is nice to see. I think, as you guys know, I'm doing some work with C4, or have been for the past months, as a captain, essentially kind of acting as a audit manager, you know, with protocols on private engagements and consultation work. So always something cooking over there, as we know. But you know, from a wider perspective, it's been good to be able to just, you know, concentrate on making new connections with researchers, and you know, hopefully in the next like 3 to 6 months we'll you know, bring it to the next level.
Yeah, like I see a lot of changes in Code Arena recently. A lot of good changes, new roles coming out, like new ways for rewarding the best ones, like hunter and gatherer roles. Like we will talk about it later, but yeah, definitely a lot of interesting things is coming up to Code Arena.
I think with your CryptoSec Diaries as well, that's pretty nice addition, because it's like nobody really does anything like that in the space. So it's something nice to see. I mean, I remember the first video that you posted, it got a lot of engagement, right? It was the size video, was it? And you know, people actually enjoyed seeing that. A lot of people enjoyed it, and it's like, yeah, it's a gap in the market by itself. But even excluding that, it's just good to do something like that. You know, provide a preview for a lot of the people of how your life is like and just how it looks for a normal security researcher, like you stated. It's actually good to do that. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I think it holds you accountable as well, because, you know, I want to just make sure I'm able to update at the end of the week what I've been doing, and for myself, like, have achievements or have met certain goals. You know, this week was very much about, you know, following up on some of the previous engagement, messaging people, setting up meetings. And, you know, I'm kind of always, I forget actually that, you know, all of us guys have kind of been working in this space for like nearly a year and a half, I think. Me and Esker have anyway. What about you, Dale? How long have you been in the space for?
The end of 2021, but it was not security when I was starting out. It was just, I thought that I would be a dev then, you know, it was a crash on the market. No one really wanted new devs. So I decided to give Web3 security a go, and I just stayed.
Nice. But I am still humbled, like when you get like a big name that follows you, right? It's always nice to get that kind of recognition. And yeah, like I forget that we've been around for quite some time now. You know, we've built our communities, our networks, we've made a lot of friends. So to them, I guess it's just, logical to connect with us now at this point. But it's nice also to see that growth over the years, you know, how far we've come in the space.
Yeah, like we are still so early. Yeah, but definitely compared to any other niche, like the biggest Twitter accounts like have like 25K followers. This is nothing compared to normal celebrities. Like maybe
That's true.
Patrick Alfasi like may have a bit more followers, but apart from that, like it rarely happens. If you are having like 5K subscribers on Twitter, like followers on Twitter, like you are already successful. If one from the guys that have like 5K plus is following you, it's like a badge for you, like that you did
Agreed,
a good
agreed.
job.
Yeah. And I think that ties back around to marketing, right? And visibility, because obviously you want the largest audience to be viewing your content and the time the content that you've spent so much time researching, right? And I think we need to be connecting with Web3 protocols directly. Whereas I think we have this habit of kind of staying within our own security community, and perhaps they don't see our content so much. So I think that's something that we should kind of like explore, maybe kind of doing like deep dives into like new protocols, new technologies. I think that could be quite good to connect with them as well.
Yeah, like definitely. This is actually a very good tip for someone that wants to break into this auditing game and create their own like auditing company, because there are many people creating content for Web3 security researchers, Web3 devs, but like not many people are doing content. Like I personally don't know anyone who does content just for the projects and the managers of crypto projects. Yeah, this actually maybe I might use this tip myself.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. To be honest, I think it also comes down to skill sets, right? Because I've seen some of your Yule, some of the content you've been delivering, Dell, and like it's very like your shit basically on a very in-depth technical perspective, right? Like back in my history, I used to work for Deloitte. I used to be a consultant for many years, and I'd have to go into like a boardroom and pitch to executives. So like I wanna, even though I love, grinding code and finding vulnerabilities, like I also want to utilize that previous skill set as well. So yeah, like I feel like the founders that I've spoken to of the web three protocols I've worked with, they some of them come from a similar background to me, and so I think I can speak their language more often than not, but yeah, like I would really love to team up to do a deep dive into some protocols, right? So if you spot one that you want to look into, just drop me a line.
Okay, cool, definitely. Like this is like I learned it recently that you should not really try to push through the things that you do not have so much experience in. You would be better off just to fill this gap in with people who have this specific skill, and you just focus on the things that are that you have expertise in. So definitely, if you have experience talking to the board, to the like company board, like right now, like moving this to Web3, like you have the very specific knowledge and expertise that not many people have, especially in this tight space of Web3. And yeah, just filling it in with someone else who maybe has some missing link would be super cool.
So, Block, with all of this in mind, right? How did your transition to Web3 go? What were some of your difficulties that you encountered?
Yeah, I mean, so I would say I don't know. Like, it's the biggest hurdle was making the decision to go full time, in my opinion, because it's, you know, it's a big commitment, right? You're giving up like monthly safety net, because you know they've got you you've got that money coming in, but at the same time, like, I thrive under pressure, and I need that motivation. Otherwise, you get into this comfort zone where you're not pushing yourself hard enough. So now that I, although I do have like quite a lot of breathing room, you know, in terms of savings and how long I can survive for, you know, I have that clock now where I know I've got to do it by a certain time, right? So that gives me, you know, I would say 10 times more motivation to do this, right? But I mean, like, in terms of hurdles and barriers and stuff, I could actually, working in Web3 and the community, like working with you guys, like, you know, we've known each other for quite some time now. You know, it made it actually an easy decision, you know, in some ways to come into Web3, because you don't make those types of connections in the corporate world. You just get stuck with the team. And that's the team with you're going to be with maybe for years on end, right? You know, you don't really get to choose who you're going to work with, whereas we have all done that basically, and found the people that we vibe with, and, you know, forge a path forward together, right? So that's it's much more on the positive aspect of things, you know, kind of moving into Web3 than the negatives.
I definitely agree. That's kind of one of the Web3 qualities I really love. It's very easy to adapt with other people, because like you're saying, it's like, you know, in Web2, you get stuck with a specific team and it's just like, you know, you have to take it from there. Whereas in Web3, I mean, you get to pick your own team. And if you do also work for a company, it's like, cool, you know, have something done by this deadline. But up until then, it's no stress, right? You could be spending 2 months on it, and it's like, they, you know, as long as you're getting stuff done, it's completely fine. It's like, you're not in a rush to complete anything. Or with somebody, you know, you enjoy working in your environment. You're very relaxed about your workflow. It's just overall completely better than Web2. So I definitely agree with what you're saying. Del, I mean, speak on this as well. Sorry, but look.
No, please go ahead.
Yeah, Del, I think you can even speak on this as well, because obviously you worked in Web2, right? So, you know, how would you say personally your experience in Web3 has been in comparison?
Chaotic. Yeah, like I like, look, maybe I look at this as chaotic because I never work at startup. I was like, what I'm doing is really only specific to big corporations, because only big corporations need my services, so that I don't get this vibe like everything has to be structured. You have like managers, and like managers approve everything that you do, and only then you can move on. And here is like, it's YOLO everywhere, and everyone like just deploys shit without proper checking to mainnet. Yeah, not verifying it. Like, developers have all the right to get all the money from the protocol, and this is just a wild ride.
Yeah, like, I feel, I think I say this to people quite a bit, actually, but whereas TradFi or the corporate world is on one end of the spectrum, like, Web3 is on completely the other end, you know? So I, like, personally would advocate that there is a healthy balance in between. And yeah, like, I still feel there is value in, like you say, is having approvals, potentially segregation of duties, but, you know, to prevent these types of insider attacks and threats. And that's something definitely I would like to develop in terms of like a framework of controls that you could take to a protocol and say, look, this is the baseline, you know, what you need to have secure ops, basically, you know?
So I do actually have another question for you. Did any of your other job skills transfer to Web3? If so, which ones specifically?
It's interesting. There's two sides of Web3, right? There's the technical side and there's the business side. And, you know, definitely the business side in terms of connecting with people, you know, networking, sales, marketing, all that kind of stuff. Like that's, you know, massively applicable. And definitely where Web3 security has been this hybrid sort of development in combination with, you know, the attacker mindset with security mindset, right? You know, those, well, I mean, my last position, I was like an information security risk manager. And always, you know, when you're assessing the severity of a vulnerability or you're looking at a protocol, you're always looking at these areas of risk, right? So I think that component, you know, not only to specific vulnerabilities, but how we can help secure a protocol and organization from a wider perspective, like that risk management experience has been really valuable. And I see a lot of use in, you know, Web3 firms kind of adopting more of a, like, you know, comprehensive risk management strategy, have accountable people that can own these risks and sign off, like Del was saying, you know, give an approval, you know. So although there is the risk, one could say, of, you know, over-engineering stuff, you know, I think just having some very baseline procedures, you know, to mitigate some of these attack vectors is a valuable thing, you know.
Okay, and like another question, but on the totally different topic, I want to question about your exercises, because I know from your diary that you're exercising a lot. And how do you see, like, when you have good training, bad training, you know, how does it impact your performance on an audit, for example?
I mean, it's a double-edged sword, I would say, because on one side of things, right, I think daily exercise, intense daily exercise, it just improves your mental health so much. You know, it releases all these happy endorphins and you feel more well mentally. However, it takes a big physical toll on your body, right? So you're physically tired and you're trying to stay alert, trying to concentrate on your work, which is difficult if you've done like 1 or 2 hours of hard training in the morning. So I think it's about finding the right time of the day, you know, which is optimal for you to train. You know, when's the best time? When do you do your best audit work, and how can you slot that that physical exercise into it? I think, like we were briefly discussing before, like diet's really important, and having, you know, really tailoring all of that so your energy levels are really where they should be. It's definitely a challenge that I'm dealing with at the moment, because I feel tired, you know, and I'm trying to keep pushing to get you know, all the research that I want to get done during the day and complete this, but it's difficult, you know. So finding a healthy balance is important, but I can't just advocate enough like just this natural way of improving your cognitive performance, like in the long run, you know, because we all know that just doing no exercise and sitting behind the keyboard huge amount of hours every day isn't great for your body or your mind, you know. What about you, Del? What are you doing at the moment?
Well, yeah, I'm just trying to make my health, you know, back to normal. As I said before, I just like ordered a fitness tracker, like looking at it and how things that I didn't realize impact me. It was like a very novel experience for me. And yeah, definitely I saw that I have to be more mindful of what I do, what I eat, and how much I move. Like in my case, I should move more, definitely. Because I'm just sitting all day for last 10 years. So definitely something to improve on. And what about you, Escrow?
Yeah, I mean, specifically in regards to the sitting, right? I was literally sitting quite literally for like 10 years as well though. So I'm almost in the exact same position, not really anymore, because around like 4 months ago, I actually got a standing desk, which transforms from just a normal desk into like a standing one. Very good, because now I can just stand at a desk for like hours upon hours. And I'm just not sitting down and destroying my hips basically. But it's actually a big problem, you know. Everybody who works in kind of any computer job, I'll say this is just a huge problem, because a lot of people just sit down, and, you know, and that's putting a lot of pressure on your hips, on your lower kind of part of your body. And then it's making it stiff as well, and then your joints are stiff, and you know they're all kind of messy. So it's actually very important to do exercises as well as have a standing desk. I mean, standing up is much more better anyway. Especially if you're doing it in breaks, like, you know, if you're doing like standing for like 3 to 4 hours and then you're sitting down for like two, for instance, you know, there's not really much going on in terms of like your body getting any pain or like any sort of like detrimental effects from sitting down. But yeah, I mean, I also go to the gym. I go around 3 times a week. I just think it's something that, you know, you need to do. I found out the other day actually that, you know, if somebody smokes and goes to the gym, they outlive somebody who doesn't smoke and doesn't go gym, which is...
Say that again. Wait, so if they smoke and they go to the gym,
yes,
they will
outlive a person.
Life.
No. They will outlive a person who doesn't smoke and doesn't go gym.
Hmm.
Right. Okay, yeah, I got you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I recently heard this this phrase that sitting is the new smoking. So, yeah.
Well,
I mean, yeah, it is genuinely bad, because then you also have to think about the quality of the chair that you're sitting on. You know, the posture of the chair, the actual, you know, just how it really affects your back, whether you're slouching or not. And then if you're not slouching, then, you know, you're maybe a little bit forward to the chair. You're not leaning back, but then your actual posture is the problem now. It's like there are so many problems with sitting down. It's actually quite crazy.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm going
to
push myself up.
The standing desk is definitely a game changer, right? I'd really recommend it if you don't have one, Del, because just being able to be standing up straight and
look.
Yeah, it's very...
It's not like I don't have one, because actually, as you can see, I do have one. But the problem is that I'm not using it. Yeah. You know, I try, like, but when I stand, like, actually my back hurts, but maybe it's because I'm so really bad with my posture and everything that just being healthy drains me.
I guess back exercises will actually help quite a lot in that aspect.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely should try it out.
Gotta save your back, man.
Okay, it was amazing. So if you agree, guys, maybe we will move on to what happened on April. What do you think?
Yeah,
I mean, there were quite a few interesting events. I do actually want to talk about the Z Casino first, right? It was quite interesting. I remember logging onto Twitter, right, and I saw like some Chinese whale hired a hitman for the person that rugged Z Casino.
Oh yeah,
it was so weird. But yeah, it was a 33 million rug pull where they converted 10.5k ETH into ZKAS tokens at inflated prices without the user's consent. Which is quite crazy. Rug pulls, I mean, yeah, I understand it when you look at Solana pump.funcoins, but Z Casino, it was very unexpected, I must say.
But was it really unexpected when the pre-audit was by ChatGPT and they, like, you know, really proudly announced this, and then the follow-up audit was by Certik? So, like, you know, I actually say it was incredibly expected that this was going to happen, right? But
I would say the hack was expected from my point of view. A rook ball, I didn't really expect it. But I can't remember what was actually picked up either.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't expecting a rook ball. I was definitely expecting a hack. But, I mean, yeah, it's just, it was kind of strange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but...
The founder as well, Mr. Elham, apparently has a history of, like, failed projects. So yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that was a trend that I didn't actually see back then.
Just anything, like, like I said, like, if it's got pre-ordered by ChatGPT, you got Certik on the menu, you know, that's something you want to stay away from, right? You know?
No, exactly.
And I think we'll talk about it a bit later on, but I've, again, like, this issue of malicious insiders And obviously, in the work that we do, centralization is not, you know, it's not going to get an award in a contest anyway, because admin is trusted, right? But, you know, in my opinion, any audit report where there is that, you know, deep centralization risk, there needs to be a disclaimer, because, you know, this is our accountability as well when we sign off an audit report and our names are on that. If we haven't called that out, and an end user is reading it, you know, considering whether this protocol is safe to use or not, then, you know, it's our reputations on the line as well. So, you know, rug pulls and, you know, I think, you know, we'll talk about an exploit later on where it was due to centralization risk. There needs to be some baseline procedures in place, like segregation of duties, you know, perhaps ownership change to a fresh fresh wallet that, you know, has been assured that it's safe by the project team to take away, you know, this sort of threat of the rogue developer or malicious developer. So some thoughts there.
Yeah, like now it came to me, it came to me that Certik is like fast food drive-through. So you are just, you know, going to the line and Certik asks you, do you want an audit? Yeah, please, you know, one audit and a cola. Okay, here we go, rubber stamp.
yeah.
Next. So and they serve like 10, 20, 30 projects every day.
Yeah.
Exactly. I actually really wanted to talk about Certik, right? But it's like this is the situation that played out with Kraken, right? I want to leave it for a future episode, obviously, when we do the recap of June. But it's like I saw somebody on Twitter say how, you know, for instance, like when you were talking about insiders, it's like North Korea obviously tried to get into like actual crypto project teams, right? What if they actually tried to get into security firms as well? And if Certik is technically compromised, because apparently the whole situation that happened with Kraken was that obviously the exact workflow is the exact same from the NK hackers, apparently, like laundering the funds through Tornado, their exact kind of deposits, like all doing it in specific timestamps and stuff. It was all looking like it was NK basically. And it's like, it questions whether Certik has been compromised, which is quite of an interesting. You know, I never really assumed that auditing firms would be getting targeted, but I mean, it's definitely plausible. Like, it's not.
I agree, man. I think it's very, very plausible, if not likely, that there are, you know, malicious insiders within security organizations, right? You know, I suppose the question is, how do you try and safeguard against that? Just, you know, personally knowing the people that you're hiring potentially. But even then, you know, in traditional institutions as well, in technology firms, I'm sure, you know, as you know, all of us work in the tech sector, we know there was a lot of controversy with Huawei, you know, the mobile provider, you know, due to potential links with, you know, having surveillance capabilities, right? Especially in the United Kingdom. So it's something that we've got to be vigilant of for sure about who we're working with. But I don't think it's possible to completely eliminate the threat, but yeah, very plausible that some of these big firms have got people inside.
I agree.
Okay, and next up we have Hedgy Finance, which was hit by flash loan attack. Like, as always, like, flash loan is just a broad term, but actually flash loan was used here because of like missing input validation of user parameters. So the attacker was able to manipulate the claim lockup parameter. Due to this, he was able to perform unauthorized token approvals and get all the tokens from the protocol, which is like really bad. Like last episode, I think we spoke about this taint analysis. Yeah, we spoke about taint analysis and how you should treat your data, input data, as tainted, and you have to like really make sure that only the data that you expect goes to the system, to the sync. But like, it happens again and again that some Some protocol actually doesn't do this properly, and they allow to do some stupid stuff for people. And I think that recently we saw many cases where, in particular, the problem was that, for example, the protocol allows you to call any function selector on their contract, which is super bad, and you should never do that.
Yeah, it was an interesting one. You know, I always try to do, you know, apart from the technical root cause analysis, like, what are the lessons learned from this, right, in terms of the wider security model? And this, with Hedgy, you know, they're actually audited by Consensus Diligence. I did like a brief background check, you know, on the auditors. There was one senior partner and one, you know, based quite junior resource, right? And, you know, as a working in that sort of consulting environment, I know that what can actually happen a lot of the time is you're assigned the senior partner who's supposed to be your, you know, mentor, be there to answer all your questions as you know, as you're doing things, but they can be completely absent. They can be quite difficult to reach sometimes. So maybe that's what happened. They, you know, they missed this critical bug. And I believe, you know, I'm not 100% accurate, but from my research, it looked like they just had the one audit, right? So obviously we, I think, are now largely advocating multiple private audits, followed by a public contest and then a bug bounty is the optimal, you know, security model, some would say. But obviously we understand that, you know, not all protocols have the budget for that. But, you know, just riding out with one private audit is, you know, in my opinion, pretty risky, right?
Yeah, definitely. But like for the protocols that can't really afford multiple audits, what would you say? What is the best, like the most economical strategy to get as secure as possible?
I think in that regard, you should hire sort of an in-house researcher, someone that you can embed into your team to do security reviews of new code. Obviously, you'd have to work out a price that they're comfortable with, and they've got to be adequate enough, you know, that they are, you know, they're filling the purpose of their role, right? But then you can probably save on costs later on, you know, by having that security resource within your pipeline. It's something that, you know, I've definitely been advocating for a long time, but it's quite, because obviously Web3 protocols largely don't follow the standard SDLC model, you know, it can be difficult to have a clear pipeline of when the security person should be engaged. But I think that's something we should work on, you know, definitely to show people like what is the optimal model, or what does the Web3 SDLC look like, you know? So that's, yeah, that's something that we could look into later. But yeah, I mean, that's my opinion anyway, to have someone in there in-house that could be consulted. And in terms of economics, just give them a retainer price per month, or, you know, agree for the project how much, you know, their consultation is going to cost, and away you go, hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we also spoke about it before. The case is, in my opinion, that right now we have like waterfall pattern in security, like in Web3, concerning security. Yeah. So first we are having this idea, then we are hiring the devs, they're writing the contracts, and security person only sees the smart contracts when it's already developed, tests are written and everything, you know, it's almost ready to put on mainnet. But this what you are saying, like hire a consultant, you know, be it like a retainer, or just pay for every hour of consultation, and you will be so much better off. Like, not only because like sometimes it's like the security researcher might see something, but you know, it is fishy, but he really can't see how to connect the dots, but the vulnerability might be there. So like even this, during the design phase, during the writing the smart contracts, the security researcher sees something and, look guys, this is fishy, it would be better if you do it differently. Like I think that this could prevent many hacks.
I think another thing as well is hiring auditors who audit just by the line. So they give a price for the actual SLOC. You know, you can just give like a whole function that you think is sus on a pretty clean code base, right? Because simplicity is key when it comes to code. So the more simple your code is, the less kind of breakable it is as well, because every single vector is basically minimized. But let's say you do have some sort of complex functions, and, you know, let's say the function is like 100 lines, is that you can give it to an auditor who uses that, you know, just a normal line by line model, and you'll get a rate per, based on that. It's like, I don't know, like $10 per line or like $16 from the very top end. I feel like that's a pretty good method as well. But I mean, what do you think, guys?
I mean, I think it's a little bit tricky because when you do the line by line approach or sort of SLOC chart rate model, right? You do your work and then it's kind of like done. You say, okay, I've reviewed this, that's that done. But we're, you know, obviously trying to take that collaborative approach where you're like, you're not just someone that's external and that's come in to do this job and you hand off the word and it's done. You know, you're there to like support them on, you know, with everything basically. So I guess from my perspective, I think the SLOC model doesn't work, you know, perfectly with that. But then again, it's just all about expectations between the researcher and the auditor. You know, I guess if it's a ballpark model, and then, you know, there's an understanding that you'll work with them until, you know, they're happy with it, then fine, right? But just in terms of like development best practices, I know like we were just, you know, previously talking about size. Like I learned so much from that code base in terms of how to write clean code. The FREIPI pattern, you know, very, very clean stuff. And, you know, giving that knowledge to developers, you know, from what we've learned, you know, through our contests and audits, is pretty valuable, right?
No, I agree. It was definitely an interesting code base. Also reading the reports yesterday, I read quite a few and I still need to read like the rest of them. But I remember a lot of the reports were quite funny with what they were reporting. I feel sorry for the judges a little bit. But it happens on every contest, you know, so it's like, you know, that's just how it is. But
yeah
it was quite
crazy. Definitely, like, obviously it's backstage, so we can't discuss the details.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I would say is, like, I saw so, like, there was some really good stuff in there, like very you know, like complex mathematical findings, which on first read seem to have a lot of merit. Maybe they'll get invalidated, maybe they won't. But there was some like GPT garbage, you know, that someone's clearly just used ChatGPT and just doesn't, their submission doesn't even make sense, you know. And like you say, I feel sorry for the judges that have to deal with that crap, you know. But what to do? It's a public contest, right? So.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Next one we have Grandbase key compromise. So Grandbase experienced 2 million exploit due to, of course, a private key leak from deployer wallet. So the attacker used the compromise key to mint and sell 32.5 GB tokens, and causing the price to plummet by 90%. Who would have thought?
Private key leak. Yeah. This is something that's just it's crazy common. I think every single episode that me and Dell make, we always see a private key leak on it. I think there might have been actually one where there wasn't, but then every single other one just has one. So it basically happens every month.
Yeah, and actually, how do you know if it's really compromised? How do you know if this is not some internal actor doing that? Like, you never know.
Yeah, like, I definitely think, you know, we touched on this, I believe, at the beginning or in a couple of parts. But this, again, you have a private key compromise. That demonstrates a failure in operational security somehow. Something's gone wrong there. You should have controls that protect against malicious insiders. And I think, you know, we discussed certainly like an ownership change in critical core contracts to a fresh wallet, to a fresh contract, fresh addresses, you know, I think should be best practice really at this point, away from the developer anyway. And that kind of safeguards the dev's reputation as well, you know, if they aren't malicious and their sort of reputation has been tainted, that's not good for them. So again, It's on both the developers and the protocols, right? Because the protocols need to deploy and implement some of these procedures. Developers should just know some of these things to protect themselves. And I guess that's where, you know, we come in as security researchers, to give that training and awareness to both parties, actually. So, you know, hopefully we can make some content on that at some point.
Yeah, definitely. So there was also the GE zero-day DOS vulnerability. I think I saw this briefly on Twitter, but I just saw like one post or two posts about it. But essentially, it was reported by IOZero on February 15th. Jason Matasaya, I really hope I'm pronouncing that correct. It was identified by such researcher, and ultimately, you could crash GEF by the ETH call payload, which would have impacted major Ethereum mainnet RPC providers like Infura, for instance, or Alchemy, Flashbots, and other ones. The bug essentially exploited out of order EIP applications during the ETH call JSON RPC calls, which triggered memory overflow conditions, resulting in the bug. So from Web2, I do actually remember memory overflow bugs were quite big, quite huge when it came to like when you go to like a hackathon or like, let me think of some events, let's say like DEF CON or something, right? It's like people will purposefully have like devices and stuff which will be, you know, vulnerable with memory overflow, and the people who attend the conferences actually just hit them and just, you know, just show how the bug exists and all this sort of stuff. Kind of like typical CTF stuff. And it's like, it's pretty interesting to see this kind of Web3, but I mean, it's still Web2 due to the nature of how GEF works. But memory overflow, I mean, it's a big bug. I do always like to see when memory overflow gets reported, because it does get quite technical very quickly with something of such level.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, how did they find it? Like, because the bug, like, in details, because me being deep into GAF implementation, I wanted to see how really the bug worked. And it was quite interesting because in GAF, you have this flag to say if it's ETH 2.0 or not. So if we are after the merge or not. And it enables some new EIPs. And the problem with that they didn't check if this flag, if it's after the merge or not. They didn't check if this is set after the specific block, which normally is used with EIPs. And it, like, this flag, if you set it, it changes how the things work, like many things work in the protocol, and this actually triggered the error. And I'm just wondering if they were doing fuzzing of the GAF client, or they were looking at the code, because, like, for those who don't know, in Web2Sec there are people who do this fuzzing, and it's not fuzzing like smart contract fuzzing. They're actually putting many random inputs to the program, and they wait for the program to crash. And when it crashes, they analyze what kind of data crashed the program and why it crashed. Because maybe, as in this case, it was some memory overflow or some unexpected condition that happened, and they are trying to weaponize this particular data that were put into the program. And then get some interesting out of it, something interesting out of it, because like, it might be some really bigger problem, and that's how the security researchers in Web2 are doing fuzzing, more or less. I'm not expert in Web2, but I know how they do it. So correct me if I'm wrong, guys.
You're pretty on point with that. Yeah, you're pretty on point with that. That is quite literally how it goes, especially when people reverse engineer applications. They do specifically look at the errors that occur when you are fuzzing an application's inputs, for instance, because it does tell you a lot about it. I mean, if you fuzz with, like, let's say, just a completely two different sets of inputs, and you get two different errors, it's like you already know where kind of the code is having problems parsing specifically inputs, and that already tells you a lot of where you should be looking, especially if you're reverse engineering. a lot of people say if you can read assembly, then everything's open source, right?
I don't know, when I was reading this, right, it kind of was reminiscent of like the zero-day Viper exploit, I thought. Just having this systemic bug that could affect the market, sorry, the landscape so widely, right? And sorry, I've just had a power cut here, so that's why the lights have gone off. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to the, well, back to the question of client diversity as well, right? So I think as of March, 34% was non-Geth or Geth, however you want to say it, right? And hopefully that improves. So if we do have these systemic zero-day vulnerabilities, it doesn't affect the whole ecosystem, right?
I agree.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving on. We have a lot of changes this spring in Code Arena. We have like Pro League, we have new roles, we have Hunter and Gatherer bonuses coming on, and many other stuff. So actually, Block, do you want to shed some light on it and talk about something of it? Because I know I know that you are the closest to Code Arena. From us. So if you could, you know, maybe even share some insider info, that would be cool.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I messaged Sock and mentioned to him that we're doing the Threat Side podcast, and if there was any sort of bits of alpha that you could share with us, you know, on the C4 movements, that would be great. And I believe this is, you know, currently under wraps. C4 should be making an announcement later on this week. But obviously we'll, you know, publish this podcast after they've done that. I've been informed that what we're going to see now is elite team competitive audits. So within the upcoming sort of OP Superchain competition that's happening in a few weeks, I believe, right? We're going to have like pro team versus pro team matchup. And I think the participants are like kind of crazy as well. Like it's Samson and TTS versus Riley Holterus and Pawning.eth. So like that's like a crazy crazy lineup, right? So yeah, I mean it's an interesting movement. And you know, certainly C4 always kind of pioneering and cooking up these new products and strategies and kind of experimenting with stuff and see kind of what works and what doesn't work. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see this in action when it happens. I mean, what are your guys' thoughts on the elite team competitive audit model?
Two things. First, this is so dope, like having the best people that there are competing in you know, such a death match is cool. But the second thing is, you know, other people that are competing, you know, in Code Arena, like against all those superstars, like come on. It's like Goliath, it was like Goliath versus David, something like that. Yeah. Totally amazing. Like, how, you know, what better security service can you get than that? But my question here is, like, how are those best people incentivized? Because, of course, the best people have many opportunities for them, like too much opportunities for them. And they will pick only the best one. So how do Code Arena incentivize the best people?
I believe what's happened here in this case is that the sponsor has given like a side pool of cash for these elite team matchups, basically. So it won't come from the main pot. So I believe, don't quote me on that, but I believe that's what the case is. And I think it also, you know, coming back to your point of David versus Goliath and the role of contests now as well, it's like almost contests now, for me anyway, they seem more like a proving ground, right? So you can say I reported X number of highs, mediums, obviously when you are elite and you've competed against the best, your skill level increases exponentially, right? Because you've got to work so much harder. And you know, at the beginning, you're not going to be making a lot of money, right, from your findings. That's just the way it is. But if you keep grinding, like, you will. And even if you don't in those contests, like, the skills that you have learned make you hugely valuable, you know, within a private context as well. So you know how to order, but potentially, you know, because the reward is split by so many people, you're not getting a decent enough payout. So you, you know, other teammates or researchers have seen your performance, they want to work with you. And so, you know, you're still getting ROI, you're still getting value out of it. But it's difficult for sure. I mean, certainly you've got to keep the faith, keep grinding. You know, it's been, I've been doing a business stuff like a lot, you know, in terms of security research and jumping on size and the eBTC ZapRouter were the first contests that I've done in so long. You know, previously we had like the technical writing analysis segment of contest, which I was, you know, really happy to do and good at. So it's like, you know, I'm starting from a low level on the pure code, you know, vulnerability discovery side. But just, you know, after doing the size contest, reading, you know, the findings of that, like, it was so beneficial, you know, to the learning process. You know, it can be disheartening, but I think just continuing grinding and understanding that every contest you do, if you work hard, like, your skills going to improve, you know, is good motivation, right? What do you think?
Yeah, like, totally agree. This is super insightful what you just said. Just keep grinding and you will finally get there. But I have like one thing here that I would like to add, because I saw it with myself many times. If you are grinding, like, really pushing yourself super hard, and there is like 3 months, 4 months, half a year, and nothing really moves on, there are two possibilities. One, you are still not there and you have a lot of things to learn, but maybe you are doing something wrong. And, you know, this, the thing that you don't have effect means that you should look, you know, from the bigger distance, like, zoom out of the experience and think, you know, what are you doing? If you are really using your time to do your best, if not, like, think about what can you improve? Like, I would personally say try to improve something after every contest, but I know like how hard it is. Like, my personal story here is, we had, because now I'm doing competitive audits with Sorry Not Sorry. We have a bunch of super cool performances, which we are super happy about. Like, for example, Blast, we are like 11th or 20th place. It was super cool. The reward was super cool. We were like third place on Wastelanding, first place on Huddle. It was invitational, but still we gathered two-thirds of the pot. We gathered Hunter and Gatherer bonuses. So basically we almost found all the issue there. And then like something broke. And then after that, like, few of our competition were really shitty. We like missed so much things, like almost all our findings were invalidated. And yeah, I was like, okay, something doesn't work here. Like, it worked and it doesn't work now. Either something changed or something has to be improved. So yeah, we are right now in the phase that we are zooming out. We left contest for 2 weeks and yeah, we are just doing a retrospective of, you know, how can we improve to you know, to come back stronger from it.
I think, like Block said earlier, it's always good to reflect on your experiences within auditing, learn where you made mistakes, and just, you know, try to not make them in the future. I mean, at the end of the day, we are humans, we will miss things, we will make mistakes. It's you know, it's just how it is. And with that being said, I feel like imposter syndrome, specifically in security research, is something that's huge. It's definitely huge. Like, sometimes I don't even want to talk about specific topics publicly in Web3 security, because like, I don't have like an amazing track record. Like, I know I can talk about it because I have the knowledge and stuff, but it's like, me personally, I don't like to talk about certain things if I don't have a completely decked out record. And whether that's imposter syndrome or not, I mean, I don't know, maybe it is. But at the end of the day, I feel like, you know, if you are talking about like some proper technical topics, it's like you should have some sort of background, or like, I don't know, achievements specifically in that area to be able to talk about it completely, regardless of if you know the topic well or not. It's just something that you just need as an addition, just to add credibility maybe to your explanation, or show that you're not just, you know, talking for the sake of it. Which I've seen some people kind of just, you know, blabble on Twitter about certain topics with absolutely no experience. So whether that's a marketing gimmick or not, I mean, I don't know. But regardless, they do a good job, you know.
Well, I think it's huge. Like you say, it's like a lot of that can be imposter syndrome. Like, you, when you're looking at the code base and you've got, you know, you think something's fishy, right? You think there could be something here. And like, you know, remember with size, we were talking about multi-call so much, you know. And is this looks like there could definitely be something here, right? And
just don't really reveal anything because it's backstage.
yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, going to talk about the specific finding itself, right?
Yeah.
But that, you know, could have been an area where, you know, so that feedback loop after each contest, like, you're learning and you're seeing, you know, what was my train of thought correct? Like, what did I miss? Like, it's invaluable. And, you know, you'll find out, you'll know your weak spots. You know, is it something like concentration? Do I need to extend that? Is it a technical subject? Do I need to learn, you know, more invariant testing, fuzzing tools? You know, what are the ways in which these bugs were found? Like, Del, I remember, you know, you had a previous finding. I can't remember exactly which contest it was on, but it was so highly contested. There was like a back and forth that was going on for
Wise,
right? Yeah.
Wise landing.
I was so interested in the methodology. Like, how did you find this bug? Because that's what's not in the report. How they found it, right? You know, it just says manual review or whatever, you know, key phrase, you know. But what was the mindset, you know, finding this bug?
Yeah, like, the video on that will be out this or next week. So you will, I go into detail how I found that. Definitely one tip that I can give for basically everyone is switching from reading line by line and focusing on functionality by functionality. So, for example, you have this one line that, I don't know, like, sets something, the second line that does some comparison, and then you have some if else. If you are going like line by line, you are losing forest for the trees. And I had this problem multiple times before. Still, I sometimes caught myself up in this mode. But just trying to really switch and think about each line as a functionality, so read between the lines, helps you to really get understanding quicker. And if you have the understanding quicker, then you can like quicker move to finding things that doesn't work. I think that, you know, this being said, we can finish today's episode. Like, guys, I hope you like it. It was super insightful. I really loved all the topics we touched. Thanks a lot.
Same. I loved it a lot. Thank you for being on here as well. Yeah, I loved it. Thank you.